And I'll lead us in a prayer, and we'll get started for the evening. All right, let's bow for just a second. Father, we do give you thanks for the day and a little bit of sunshine towards the end of the day, but we thank you for being Lord and Master over all creation, providing rain and sustenance to the earth. And we pray you do that for us as well, not just of bread, for food, but bread for our very souls. We thank you for one another, that we can encourage one another in our studies, and that we can sharpen each other's minds by discussion, by contending with the readings and topics that we cover. And may we indeed sharpen our decision-making skills for ethical decisions. May we be even more so developing in our character more and more into the likeness of your Son, and that our behavior, our actions, our deeds are simply manifested out of our very hearts as to the very nature of what we are like, because we are mirroring him. Again, thank you for this evening, and walk with us through the night and keep us in your safety and care. Through Christ we pray. Amen. Amen. All righty then. Well, this is right at the beginning of that first chapter we're to have read, chapter 4. And it mentions a guy, an ancient Greek, Aristides, and his work, The Apology. And he made the case, this is, you know, early centuries of the church, and he said his argument was to the pagan world around him that Christianity was valid or true based on the Christian moral character of the adherents, of the Christians of that time. And I just really am curious. I just wonder what you think of that argument. Could we make that same argument today? Could we say to secular America, Christianity is true because just look at the people, look at the Christians and their moral rectitude, their moral uprightness. Could we make that claim?
You can't tell the difference.
Yeah. And what any particular areas you think that we look just the same as the culture around us? Any particular aspects of life behaviors or actions?
A lot of it is language. And some of it is the activities that people participate in. And I think that, you know, some things done in moderation aren't necessarily a bad thing, but, you know, excessive, you know, things that are done to excess, or things that, if you were to go out with your buddies and you're have, you know, everybody's drinking and you're drinking and your behavior is just like theirs, that's completely different than, you know, being able to, you know, maybe sit and have a glass of wine and socialize with some people and behave, you know.
What do you think, Corey? Is her assessment fairly accurate? Or
I agree with her. And I think how we judge people, how a lot of Christians, we really, I mean, we say one thing and we might try to act like we do one, I mean, something different, but a lot of Christians are really judgmental. I mean, they really are. And that's what pushes a lot of people away from Christianity. They're like, why would I want to be with somebody who's always talking down on me? And nobody likes to be talked down on, whether you're wrong or right.
Yeah, there's a guy at University of Virginia. He's a sociologist, Christian sociologist, Hunter. Is that right? The last name's Hunter? Is that right? Anyway, he's done several works and looking at some of the surveys from Barna and so forth. But basically, with regards to, say, divorce and remarriage and several other social things like that, that Christians stack up just the same as the general populace. Very little numerical difference in numbers. And so he's saying, at least in particularly in the evangelical world, that it's hard to make any visible distinctions in life practices than the culture at large around us. And of course, that's problematic. I mean, it's a shame that we can't make the same argument as Aristotle did in second, third century about just look at the Christians, look at the way they live and the way they behave as a stark contrast to the Greco-Roman world around them. And people had to, you know, nod the head. Yeah, you're right. They do live good moral lives. Now, in his time period and context in the pagan world, it didn't take a whole lot of righteousness to look righteous compared to a lot of the stuff that's going on. So there maybe is that little bit of a more of a clear distinction that could be made. But, you know, it's tough that our culture has, like a waterfall, washed over us and has affected us more than we've been able to push back against it as far as moral behavior. And that's not saying, though, that Christians aren't in still some ways distinct, or that there's maybe within Christianity, within the core, there are people who are truly distinctive in their moral behavior and that they are noticeably distinctive. Peter, come on in.
There he is.
How are you, sir? But I just thought it was striking contrast for us to address of his argument with full confidence. I can just simply point to the Christians of my time and they will recognize the difference. But we can't make that. In fact, in a general way, people, if we try to make that argument today, it would fall flat very quickly because it'd be all the accusations, like you say, particularly judgmentalism and so forth.
I remember I was taking a business trip with my boss, and everyone knows my faith. I'm very open about it and share. And we go on this business trip, and while we're traveling, he starts telling me about the mission trip that he and his family were going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we got back, he felt very comfortable talking to me about it because, you know, he knows my faith. But I was completely shocked.
Oh, surprised.
Because nothing in his behavior would have ever led me to believe that he even goes to church, let alone that he and his family do mission trips.
Yeah, some of those outward behavioral traits don't belie your faith enough. You know, that's a shame.
And you wonder how someone corrects their behavior that much. You know, remember your surroundings so that you can control your tongue. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, those of us that, you know, act the same way all the time don't have to think about that.
Yeah.
But someone who doesn't, you know, has to really actively control their behavior whenever they're, you know, if they're only Sunday morning Christian.
And that goes back to that early depiction, I think our first class session I gave with regards to virtue is a an intellectual, I mean, it's a reasoned choice that you make it a habit to such an extent that it becomes part of you, becomes a disposition. And so it's not an issue for you to have to control your tongue and all that, but for someone to turn it off and on is not very easy to do because it's not part of them yet, you know. So. Peter, you came in just on the tail end of the discussion. I've mentioned in chapter 4, the beginning, it talks about the Greek, ancient Greek guy, Aristotle, and his work, The Apology, and said that he could make a case. In fact, that was what he was doing in The Apology. He was defending the faith by simply saying, look at the Christians' moral lives, and that will convince you of the truth of the religion. And I ask, do you think that could be an argument we could use today? That just look at Christians' lives and their upright living and quality and so forth would make the case for the Christian faith. Do you think that we could do that? Is that still an argument?
I think we can make a case, but not all beings which are good.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I wonder, actually, asking you if it would be an easier case to make that it's Kenya, right? In Kenya, than it would be in the U.S. Those who are claiming to be Christians in the U.S., would it be harder to make the case to say Christianity is true because look at their lives? Or would it be more easily made in Kenya to say, look at the Christians in Kenya and you can see the distinction of how they live as Christians? Maybe I'm being too hard of my own country, but...
You see, Christianity in Kenya, I think for the last 50 years, just been growing rapidly. And now people have, of course, different perspective, you know, when they... Because, you know, firstly, when it was a colony, there was like, there was a Christian persecuting, you know, other people.
Oh.
Like they did here to slaves. So But there it was not like that. It was, you know, different because you never had slaves. It was a colony anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, but if now Christian has grown and people have, most of the people have realized the benefit of Christianity,
mm-hmm.
And they can see the...
the advantages it gives of being Christian.
Good development, you know. And they can see homes, whose homes which are Christian or which they are Christians.
Mm-hmm.
Things are good, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Other than Christianity, what is put on the faith there?
We have the Muslim, yeah.
Is that a huge conflict to have so many people converting to Christianity?
No, but Muslims are in Mombasa, mostly. Most of them are in Mombasa, although even in the countryside they are there, but Muslim, in Mombasa, they were influenced in early, development of the country when the Arabs used to come there, you know. It's very close to the Arab countries.
Mm-hmm.
They brought Muslim first before the Christian came in. So the town of Mombasa is more Christian, Muslim than Christian.
Mm-hmm.
But Christian, and even there was a time, some time back when there was some, a bit of conflict between, you know, Christians and the Muslim, because a lot of Christians now we can now say it's 50-50, 50 Muslim and 50 Christians.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Muslims owns the property there because they were the first people to settle in the city.
Well, I've heard that in some of the region over there that Muslims work harder at spreading their faith than the Christians
mm-hmm.
do.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, that's what they are trying to do. Like the Al Shabaab is now trying to spread Muslim there forcefully. It's like they are doing it forcefully.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when there was this mole attack, terrorist attack,
mm-hmm.
they were asking people, are you a Muslim? If you are not a Muslim, they would kill you. That's
mm-hmm.
what they did. And that is what also they did. There is a bus they attacked on the northern part of Kenya, and they still ask that same question.
So you think a lot of people say they're Christians say they're Muslims just to stay away from persecution? Or do you think there's more Christians than actually claim to be Christians?
No, well, there are more. Actually, there are more Christians than Muslims. That's a fact. But
say hi to Whitney. She's joining us. Hello, Whitney.
Hello, Whitney.
You there?
Mm-hmm.
No, she's muted.
Mm-hmm.
Whitney.
I'm here.
Hello. Okay. We just wanted to welcome you to class. Say hi to you.
Thank you.
Okay. We were just discussing the ancient Greek that's mentioned in the first part of chapter 4. Aristides and his book, The Apology, in which he makes the claim, you know, in his time, saying that, well, I can, you know, show Christianity is true and valid just by looking at the moral lives of the Christians. And I was asking the question, do you think we could make that same argument today? Could we point to Christians in their behavior, their moral uprightness, to convince people that Christianity is true? And just wondered what you thought about that.
I think in certain situations you can. I don't think there's really one Christian that follows like the exact same morals or values as the next.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely do think that it is possible.
Yeah, I think maybe some individual lives or small groups, but in general, some of the ideas brought up was that in general, people in our own country look at Christians with being too judgmental, or that their life behavior is not anything different from everybody else's as far as language and whatever. So that, you know, that's a shame that it's not, we can't more easily point to the distinctiveness of Christians' life and life behavior and actions to validate the faith. Although there are, I think you're right, I think there are individuals and I think there are moments and contexts which we can, you know, something comes to mind would be, it's just been a couple of years ago, where that Amish, those Amish girls were killed and then the parents forgave the shooter or shooters, I guess. And I saw several talk shows or interviews and so forth, and they're asking counselors or psychologists, is this, are these parents being genuine? Are they real? And said, I'm convinced they truly have forgiven these people. It's incredible as it is. And I think, if not, there's a moment, I mean, at least a little bit of a window into the Christian faith of its extraordinariness of being able to do that. So there are those moments. Well, what he does in chapter 4 is kind of track through historically to give a background to, as we move towards, you know, personal moral positions and decision-making. But he begins with the early church and the tendency in, even in the first century to some extent, but then also particularly second, third century, Christianity kind of, or a lot of Christians kind of pull out from culture. They kind of isolate themselves. What do you think, well, the book gives you some reasons. Let's just, you tell me, what were the reasons for the church pulling back like that or isolating itself from the Greco-Roman culture at large? It's open to anybody. Jump in there.
Part of
Wasn't it due to...
Go ahead, Whitney.
Didn't it have something to do with the fast increase from, like, the low-income families?
Right, yeah. A lot of the converts to Christianity were of the lower class, and so they really didn't have... They weren't in positions of power to affect change in the culture very much, although you do see in the book of Acts and in the Corinthian letters, when the mentioning of names and so forth, and in the book of Acts, there were some converts of, and particularly women of high standing, that they were of magistrates in cities and so forth. So there were some early on, but by and large, probably in the larger numbers were people who were not power brokers in society. There was some of that. You had people even in, there were converts even within Roman government and so forth. But generally speaking, they were lower class. But what are some other reasons possibly for the church's isolation or kind of not engaging the culture at large that much?
Just that the general attitude that people had toward them and the persecution that they endured was part of it.
Yeah, certainly a factor has to have been a pretty clear... they against us kind of thing because of the persecutions, particularly in on into the early part of the second century. You had Diocletian. First, you had Nero in the 60s. And Nero was such a maniac. There was a fire that, of course, Rome, an ancient city, had a lot of wood structures, and you had to have stoves and fire for heat and cooking in your apartment buildings. So usually the apartment buildings would go three, maybe four stories high. They're all wood, and you know, you have all this fire going on. You're going to have a lot of fires. Well, there was a big fire that burned down maybe a third of the city one time, and the story is that Nero blamed the Christians to divert it from any attention to him, and as punishment, he lined the Appian Highway, the road that came up from the port up the Tiber to the city. He lined that highway with crucifixes and had Christians he killed on the crucifixes and set them ablaze to be like streetlights. And so even there's even a comment from a Roman magistrate saying, you know, having pity for the Christians who they typically didn't like, but having pity for them, knowing it was the deranged Nero seeking revenge on them. So it just kind of gives you the kind of animosity towards Christians, particularly in some of the occasions when Roman emperors persecuted them. You know, Diocletian, even Marcus Aurelius did some. He was a Stoic and very upright, moral man, but he also persecuted some of the Christians. So you have that tension. What are some other things? That general, like you said, general animosity. I mean, a lot of early church got bad press, just like we feel like the church gets today. Things like the Christians were cannibals because they ate the flesh and blood. So that got passed around, that they were cannibals. Also that they were incestuous because they loved their brother and sister. You know, they would take people and hear these things and extrapolate, right? So there was a lot of bad press about who these Christians were. What else might have been some of the reasons for the church kind of being in isolation from the culture?
Well, there was just a huge moral discrepancy between the Christians and the non-Christians, the way they lived their lives, and the Christians mm-hmm. didn't want to associate with them, even though Christians were to be the salt and light. You were to be in the world, but not of the world. But mm-hmm. they didn't take that approach. Instead, they just separated themselves from the world so that they wouldn't be associated mm-hmm. with those behaviors.
Wouldn't look like you're blending in with them. Yeah.
It's probably difficult to be a Christian. I mean, really difficult. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's why they hung on to each other so tightly. I mean, the idea of the church, the body, the group that you're with, you know, you really clung to them because truly they became your new family. But a lot of times they were being cut off from family members and that whole network making the commitment to Christ. The new people they had to be with were Christians. You know, they couldn't easily mingle back and forth as much as perhaps we can.
It was such a young, immature Christian age that mm-hmm. they weren't strong enough to associate with the non-Christian mm-hmm. people.
Well, yeah, the danger of slipping back into it, yeah, into pagan practice.
And your own family doing it, and you being kind of shoved out by your own family. Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody wants to get burned on the streets either. Mm-hmm.
Right.
I mean, it might just because you're scared. You might want to be a Christian, but mm-hmm.
It was a genuine commitment. Yeah.
That'd be difficult for me. I mean, I don't know how I would feel if people were getting burned down the streets. I would hope I would still be a Christian and pray and be the same, but I couldn't mm-hmm. tell you I would be.
Mm-hmm. And the persecutions weren't constant to the first and second century. They were sporadic, sometimes just in different regions for a few years, and it let off, but nevertheless, it occurred. So it kind of gave you, as a Christian, you'd have this sense of we against they kind of thing. You know?
Well, that's like saying we got terrorist attacks every now and then, but we're always on alert for the terrorist mm-hmm. attacks still.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and you never know when some...
Yeah, we still have all the airports extra locked down. We probably will for who knows how long.
Yeah, and the Christians never knew what emperor might come into power and unleash another mm-hmm. round of... persecution, and it was of different degrees of intensity. Trajan, there's a famous letter that Pliny, a regional magistrate, wrote Trajan asking what to do with these Christians, you know, and he describes even one of their worship services, and Trajan answers back and says, well, you know, try to get them to recant, you know, tell them to quit being a Christian. If they don't, maybe take their goods and throw them in jail, that kind of stuff. So it wasn't always killing them, but it was kind of an awkward legal move on their part. We don't really know what to do with them. What do you suggest? You know,
and that'd be even worse, not knowing what's going to happen.
Yeah.
At least you know you're going to get eaten by a lion. Yeah, I mean, okay, I'm going to get eaten by a lion. No.
Yeah. Any other factors you see there in the text that cause the church to be tend towards being isolated?
Pretty much all I remember.
Well, one of the other things it does mention, though, is the eschatology, the notion of the imminent return of Christ. And so why try to get engaged with the culture and civilization so much? Because it's all going to end here pretty quick. You know, Christ is going to return, and all this will end. So, you know, the most the priority is, you know, convert more people. And so it's that kind of a perspective and not trying to, you know, engage with the culture to affect it for good and that kind of thing. So that might have been another factor.
Well, but probably most, well, certainly the persecution, but I think also the moral difference. You were really truly being called out of the world when you became a Christian because of the typical behavior of the particularly Roman culture. The Gentiles in the Jewish mind were just despicable in the way they lived. And that's why you see, by the way, you know, in Acts 2, it mentions those people from all over the different countries, and some of them were God-fearers and proselytes. Those are non-Jew converts to Judaism. And the reason that occurred is because there were some pagans who saw how well Jewish people lived, you know, that they were morally upright people. And they were attracted to that, just like some of the philosophers tried to call people to right kind of living, at least to be, you know, be honest and, you know, responsible and all that stuff. And so, like Judaism, Christianity did have a drawing factor because it was so distinctive in living upright lives compared to, in contrast, the Gentiles. That's also why the church had a little trouble with the Gentile conversions, because Jewish Christians think, man, we can't let these guys come in here without cleaning them up, you know. We need to impose the Jewish law to make them live uprightly, you know, to live right. But they were trying to use law to do that and not grace. Well, the text also mentions kind of the hot spots of ethical issues for the early church in the first few centuries. It names five of them. Rattle off some of those for me. These would be things, these are topics that, say, some of the early church fathers wrote about or different preachers in the early, like, second century and so forth. And even Paul would address somewhat.
Talking about the reason in Revelation, sin, evil, and good.
But this would be the moral issues that the church had to face and contend with. That were topics that they tended to address.
I'm sorry. I think I didn't catch the whole question.
No, that's fine. Let me say it again. The book lists five different topics or themes, moral themes, that the church, early church, tended to address and were kind of big in focus for them.
Well, slavery, state, military service.
Yeah, that list. The first one being wealth. What was the problem with the wealth? What did the early church, what does in general the church say about wealth?
Pretty much what it's difficult for a rich man to be truly saved, mm-hmm. because he worships money instead of.
Yeah, that there's a danger of wealth making you more connected to this world than being connected to Christ. That it's an allurement or an attraction. A temptation. Yet, it doesn't denounce wealth altogether, but gives a lot of warnings about it, just as scriptures do, right? And then slavery, although you have lots of references to slaves in the New Testament, not to cause a overturning of that practice as much as treat them as equals in the faith. Especially with the little letter to Philemon, and Onesimus is that runaway slave that Paul's sending back to Philemon and asks him to receive him back as a brother because he's now a Christian. He's converted to the faith. So just the practice of the faith in converting people, including slaves, to Christianity had its own way of undermining slavery, not by governmental laws to overturn slavery, but changing the understanding of the relationship to slaves, that they're now your brother in Christ or sister in Christ. And so it turned it upside down a little bit just by the relationships.
And then also a biggie was the relationship of the church to government or to the empire, to the state in general. And your text mentions two passages, two key passages addressing it. One's from Paul and one's from John. You see those?
Romans 13 and Revelation 13.
Yeah. Romans 13, what does Paul say how we should be in relationship to the state, to the government?
It says we should obey the authority.
Mm-hmm. Submit to the authority.
And to pay the taxes.
Right, pay the taxes, submit to governmental authorities. Mm-hmm. They've been put in that position by God's providential care, and they are their function is to maintain order and peace. And even an unjust government still can be viewed as something God ordained to maintain a sense of order.
Isn't that hard to swallow these days?
Oh, sure it is. Mm-hmm. Sure it is. In a sense, we're kind of spoiled because we do have, although we don't exercise as well as we should, we do have a participatory government, which we can blame the government, but we're also a part of it in a sense that we can vote and influence and that kind of thing. But there are other countries where that's certainly not the case. And yet Paul says to be obedient to them and maintain order, be at peace, that kind of thing. By contrast, then, you've got John in the book of Revelation, chapter 13. What's being said about the government there?
Beast is out of the sea.
Yeah,
that's kind of scary, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's probably referring to, with the symbolism and so forth, to the Roman Empire and, you know, really painting a very bleak picture of being an arch enemy to the church and the faith. So you have these two contrasting depictions and yet somehow hold together. And, you know, it depends on context. Our current context, it's a lot easier to say, yes, be obedient to your government and pay the taxes and so forth. If you're in a totalitarian, abusive government, it's a little harder to swallow, and yet there's not a whole lot you can do unless you want to create an insurrection or something and take up arms. But in general, this is a tension for the early church, and guess what? This continues to run through the medieval period because of the entanglement of the church with governmental powers. And we'll address that in a minute. And two other topics come to mind, too, that were toughies to deal with in the early church. Whitney, let me bring you in here. Do you see that section about the different ethical issues the early church addressed?
Starting on page 85.
Yeah, beginning of page 85. We've mentioned the government or state, slavery, wealth. There's a couple other ones. What were those? Still with us?
Do what?
I'm reading.
I think so, the military.
Ethics of the military.
Yeah, being a military. Yeah, Whitney, one of them was just mentioned being in military service, whether a Christian should be able to do that. And do you see the other one? There's one more.
Are you talking about the issue of capital punishment?
Yes, uh-huh. That's the other one. The church debated whether or not it was good and right for the exercise of capital punishment, the executing of someone, a criminal or whatever, whether the government or state should do that. With military service, generally speaking, there were lists given of things Christians shouldn't be a part of in the early church, even into the fourth century. And one of them is military service. Several authors said, no, you shouldn't do that. You certainly shouldn't become a Christian
and then go into military service. If you're a Christian and as you are already a soldier, you know, that's kind of overlooked because you're already in that position. But in general, there was this teaching and instruction and position that, no, you shouldn't be in the military in a possible position of taking other lives. In other words, a more pacifist position. But these things were debated, all five of these. And you have, as we've indicated, you have scriptures that deal with these topics, but it's not always real clear cut. And the church debated and had, you have different figures holding different positions. I remember reading the text from Chrysostom on wealth, and it's truly an intriguing piece. And he's referred to as Golden Tongue because he was such a popular preacher in his time, and talking about the danger of wealth and so forth. And it's really instructive, really, really good insight. And it gives you a picture of attitudes of the time.
What do you think?
Concerning wealth?
No, concerning Christians going to
military.
Military.
Well, I think in our context, you can enter the military, and there's so many positions you can be in that you'd never have to be in the position of frontline fighting. You can do all kinds of positions and roles in the military and serve your country in that capacity without having to take up an arm and actually shoot somebody.
Maybe not directly, but indirectly.
You're supporting it, yeah, yeah. And, you know, that's one of those things of conscience I think each individual has to be honest and truly wrestle with, rather than just making a blanket statement, boom, this is the church's stance, or you know, do this or not do this. Certainly there's been a lot of Christians who have participated in the military, and the bigger picture behind that is the whole issue of the just war doctrine. Augustine started, Aquinas played it out even further, of looking at criteria of what makes for a just war, that it's one of those conditions that it's the lesser of two evils of fighting against someone like Hitler or whatever. And those are never should never be comfortable or easy decisions. So I think context and circumstance and one's own individual conscience has to work through that. So, well, that's the early church. It's at least up through the first five centuries. You have some really dramatic examples of isolation because you have the beginning of the hermits, like St. Simeon, and the beginning of the monastic movement. You had the Cenobitic and the Anabitic types of monasticism where they would go off as hermits or they'd go off as groups. And the reason for that was, and this developed like after the 4th century, because what's called Constantinianism, or when Constantine became emperor. What was the story with that? What's the deal with, why was there this shift when Constantine became a Christian?
Wasn't it or something with his mother?
No, that's Augustine.
Oh. Well, I mean, I know that he's the one that legitimized Christianity, but I was thinking it had something to do with his mother, being an Anglican or something.
Well, Augustine's mother prayed for years and years for him to become a Christian.
Okay.
Constantine was a general, and he was about to face the enemy outside of Rome, the Moldavian bridge. And they say, the story is, he had this vision the night before the battle, and that he saw up in the sky a cross, and was instructed, or he instructed his army then the next morning before the battle, to put a cross on their shields, and by this, because I think he heard the voice, by this you shall win or be victorious or something. And so all the soldiers put crosses on their shields. They won the battle. And shortly thereafter, you had the Edict of 311 that made a toleration of Christianity, so there's no more persecution. Then I forgot to look up the exact dates. It wasn't long after that, 381. It became the state religion, and 390, I think it was, that they outlawed paganism. So a complete reversal in about 80 years. less than 80 years. Now, what do you think the case would be if this small wealth, this undergroup of the society, Christians, suddenly not just became not persecuted, but then became accepted, and then within a generation became the dictated state religion of the empire? What do you think would be the quality of converts to the church?
Maintain separation from society.
Well, I think that you'd have a lot of people who didn't really believe, and they were just saying that because it was what the mandated religion now.
Yeah, I mean, if you wanted to advance in the military or advance in government or business, whatever, you, because it's now pronounced as from the emperor that, in an edict that this is the state religion, a lot of people were becoming Christian that weren't really converted, right? That they were name only. And because that happened in mass, you know, huge numbers became, quote, Christians, the church became pretty anemic morally. Mm-hmm. And its faith was, you know, even in leadership positions, because you could get some nice cush positions being a bishop, whatever, being appointed by some magistrate and be a bishop in the church and not hardly believe any of that stuff. You might know to talk it, but you didn't practice it.
You're saying just a bunch of fraud started coming out of the woods?
Well, just that it was a kind of like a blanket you put on. You know?
Or the norm now.
Yes, yes, exactly. Becomes the norm. And so that there's a lot of immorality in the church, in Christianity. And that set off guys like Simeon, who went out into the desert. The book, your text talks about him. It starts off sitting on a pole a few feet up above the ground to get to not be tainted by the world. It was a dramatic, it was like one of those prophets in the Old Testament who does something kind of bizarre to get attention or to make a point. Well, he does it by being unworldly, by being no longer part of the world because of seeing sin being so pervasive. And it mentions by the end of his life, his pole gets higher and higher and higher. And he lives up on this little platform on this pole, 60 feet high. But people kept coming out to him to ask for spiritual guidance, direction, and understanding, and so forth. So he was a hermit, but even all the hermits had people that would come and seek them out for spiritual wisdom.
He had a tree house.
Yeah.
Can you imagine living like that for 36 years, though?
Yeah.
He was proving a point. Apparently it worked.
What? That's the thing. It would not be, any of us would not consider that to be the normative practice.
Mm-mm.
Yet sometimes the abnormal
is what we search for.
Well, or it can be used to call people back or to call people towards holiness. And you had guys like Benedict who tried to be a hermit and said, man, I can't do this. So he started a monastic movement, which they lived in communities. And they farmed and so forth. And they served villages around them, but they lived in very ordered lives of prayer and worship and work. And each day had this shape to it, you know, prayer time, work time, rest time. It was very organized, if you will. And
so to them, it was a way of life and had nothing to do with a belief system because it was just being handed down. And since it was mandated, this is you know, it's just like you have to send your kids to school. Well, and you have to live your life in this way. But it had nothing to do with any kind of a belief system because no one was teaching that belief system.
But the monastic order certainly recognized that. So they wanted to be fervent in their faith and practice and pray and so forth because they saw the sinfulness being so pervasive. So it's like creating little islands of holiness or trying to. But they had their problems too. So that's one of those church's responses, Christendom's responses to the culture at large. One is isolation like that. Then you have the medieval period, getting past a little bit the Constantinian, you know, surge of making it the state religion. Medieval, you had this entanglement of the state kingdoms and the church, and there was a real battle that went on for several centuries of, okay, who rules who? Like who's over who? Is it the government or the church? And there are some interesting turns of events. Like in the eastern half of the empire, after it split, in the Byzantine Empire, you had Justinian, who killed about 3,000 people. There's a chariot race, there's an uprising, because it was very political, and he killed 3,000 people. And I think it was Ambrose who called him to task. So here's a bishop calling this emperor to task for the sinfulness that, and forcing him, well, imposing on him, if you want to be part of the church, he had to seek repentance. And he did. So there's one of those moments where the church was over the empire or over an emperor. And it was a visible, everybody knew about it. But then you had other times in the western part of the empire, you had the emperor or kings, whatever, appointing bishops, and they kind of ruled the church. Well, eventually one of the images that came up with was that the church should be like the sun and the kings should be like the moon, which they reflect the light of authority from the church, but they themselves are not the sun. But believe me, that was not easily won out, that kind of understanding of relationship between church and state, and it still was messy. Text mentions Thomas Aquinas and his synthesis of Aristotle's philosophy and Christian doctrine. I think he's a little rough on Thomas Aquinas because he does achieve some pretty good stuff. And he's not just a rationalist, Aquinas wasn't, because he also, towards the end of his life, turned back on all of his writings. His Summa Theologica is about a multi-volume set about this big. It's huge. And he wrote another one about the same size called Summa Contra Gentiles. Massive amount of writing. And anyway, towards the end of his life, he said it's all rubbish. And then he wouldn't write anymore because he said, you know, God himself is just beyond our knowing. He's too great and grand, that kind of thing. He became kind of a mystic. Well, we're going pretty fast with this, but then there was the Reformation. So in the medieval period, you had church and state, or the culture and the church intermingled, right? It was one, almost one of the same thing. Reformation, this break with the Catholic Church and its low ebb of really
playing the
bad behavior.
So somebody is playing the drums.
Yes, yes. I've experienced this teaching class here in the morning, too, sometimes.
Are you serious?
But the Reformation comes, you have Calvin and Luther, referred to as more of the magisterial reformers. Then the Roman Catholic Church did their counter-reformation, trying to clean up its act too. And then you had the radical reformers like the Anabaptists and so forth, who really pulled out from the culture, who were isolationists a bit more. Whereas Calvin, you know, he went to Geneva, Switzerland, and he wrote, he was a lawyer by trade, and he wrote much of the laws and really kind of set up the government for the city state of Geneva in Switzerland. So it was very much co-mingled together. So all that is to say, this is like throwing a rock on the water and just touching down occasionally. History of Christianity, very quickly, just saying that you have times of engagement with the culture, then you have times of isolation. Even within the Reformation, you had both and. You had Calvin particularly engaging the culture, trying to affect it, even saying, you know, kind of making a Christian government and that kind of thing, whereas you had the radical reformers who pulled away from the culture and so forth in isolation. Both of those extremes are problematic, and even trying to say, well, I'm just kind of in between. Well, that's hard to do, too. Of what the right relationship is between the church and the culture in which it's planted, in which it lives and grows. Now, the text pulls up a classic text by Niebuhr on the five models of the relationship of church and state. And what I'd like us to do here for discussion, see there's four of us, apart from me. First thing I want each one of you to do, I'll give you just a couple minutes and then respond, are those five different models that Niebuhr mentions: church against culture, church of culture, church above culture, church paradox with the culture, and church as transformations or conversions of culture.
which of your individual congregation, that covers several pages in the text, which of those five models do you think best describes your particular congregation where you attend? And then I want to ask, which of those five models do you think the church should take as a stance in relationship with the culture around us?
Can you repeat the first question again?
Yeah, in the book, I forgot what page. I have.
91, but it gives three there, and then there's five of what the scholars put together. But
yeah, the three are the, the first two is being against culture or being of culture.
Oh, okay, I see. What
and then he breaks it down into the above culture, paradox of culture, or transformer. Yeah, Whitney, the question is, first, which of those five models that Niebuhr gives us, do you think describes best what your particular congregation is like as far as its relationship to the culture? The second question is, then, though, what do you think the best of those five models are for the church in relationship to the culture? Does that help? Does that make sense?
And this goes all the way over to page 96, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, he's trying to describe each of those five models. For those listening to the recording, I'm going to give us a couple minutes for everybody to review that real quick. But as you're listening to the recording, you might want to think through that too. Which model fits your church? And then which one do you think would be the best model for the church at large to practice? Of course, part of the problem is that even as Niebuhr says, some of these five models, they do tend to overlap a little bit. Anybody else joining us? Daniel.
Hello, yeah, I'm here.
Daniel, what we're doing right now, because we're kind of quiet, is we're looking at those five models in chapter 4 that Niebuhr gives of how the church relates to the culture.
What page is it on?
I think what did you say, 91?
Yeah. 90.
Or 90?
93, but yeah, it starts on 91, but the descriptions go all the way through to like 99 or somewhere.
So those five different models, church against culture, church of culture, church above culture, church in paradox with the culture, or church in transformation or transformer of culture, we're asking two questions. One is, what is your particular church you think, which of those five models does it fit? And then secondly, which of those five models do you think is the way the church ought to relate to the culture around it?
Okay.
Yeah, well, everybody look at that for a few minutes and we'll go around the table and...
So the church of the sinner is two, or the church of the church sinner is the just the.
The church and the sinner would be those three.
And then the radical answers would be.
The first two are the extremes, being against or of culture, and then in the center you have church above culture, mm-hmm. church in paradox, or church in transformation, or transformer of culture. Well, I'll get started and then we'll just go around the table and you can keep looking and so forth. But the congregation I'm attending right now, because we just moved back to Dallas this summer, so we've just been there, what, 4 or 5 months. But we knew the congregation when we were here before 10 years ago, but it's changed quite a bit. And so I would say that congregation is a mix of church against culture, but also a little bit of, well, quite a bit of culture too, because on the one hand, they want to be, the typical phrase, they want to be relative, you know, to be relative to the culture so we can make converts and so forth. But there's also still a sense of isolation, of not wanting to be a part of the culture fully. They have a really strong ministry in recovering addicts and prisoners, you know, who've just gotten out of jail, trying to help them make the transition from prison to normal life. And they're very, very involved in that and do really good work. So in that sense, I think they really fight to be against culture because these guys have been so caught up in it, you know, drug and all kinds of things. But they're also of culture trying, they kind of mimic aspects of culture around them in the name of being relative to the culture, you know, to be... well, to identify with the culture so that they can win some. So there's that tension of those two. I'll not yet say what of the five models I think the church ought to be in general, but I'll go ahead. Gina, what of your particular congregation, of the five models, which one do you think your church fits into?
Well, we had been going to one church for quite some time and changed a couple of years back because an old pastor had come and taken over a local church and we wanted to be supportive of him,
mm-hmm.
but it hasn't been a good church home for us. And so mm-hmm. we've been looking the last 6 months. We've been, I guess you call it church shopping.
Mm-hmm.
We've visited one for a while and then, you know, another one for a while. We've ended up coming full circle and back to the first one that we visited. And I would say that it very closely aligns with my own beliefs, because that was the whole reason we were doing process was to find the one that best, you know, fell in line with our own beliefs. And that, to me, is being a transformer.
Hmm.
So, you know, as you said, you can mimic some of society as far as just to make people feel welcome, but that doesn't mean that that's really who you are.
Yeah.
You know, having a more contemporary service, having, you know, fifth quarters after the football game, mm-hmm. things like that to attract the kids and bring them in is different, I think, than being of the culture.
Yeah.
But I definitely think that being a transformer of culture is where, you know, is where Christians should be, at least in my belief system. And so I feel like that's where both my church and I
are. You engage the culture for the intent of trying to transform it. Okay. Whitney, what do you think? What of those five models do you say your church would be like?
I was kind of leaning towards the transformer model as well, simply because, I mean, you do get people that come from all over and everybody's from different cultures, and it can kind mm-hmm. of be of havoc when you're trying to basically feed everyone's needs based off of what their culture entails. And if, not to say that if everyone's on the same page, but if everyone is kind of expecting the same thing out of a church home and service and things of that nature, I think it would make for a good church home.
Okay. So you see your particular congregation as being transformative kind of church in relationship to the culture?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. I'll skip you, Daniel, for just a minute and come back to you and give you a little more time. Corey, what do you think? What about your congregation, and then what do you think?
I think mine's a lot like yours, against culture and of culture, because like the pastor's actually my brother. And
you should be really kept in line then, right?
Right. Yeah, no, right. The motto is no perfect people allowed. So they really, like you said, we have a lot of people that are ex-cons and a lot of, but everybody gets along with each other and they try to help us deal with what's going on in our lives today, not just what happened, like just reading through the Bible and telling us what we should and shouldn't do. They tell us like stuff that's going on now and stuff that we can do now with our culture, even though they don't want us to exactly follow the culture, like you said, but they're trying to make improvements on it.
Yeah. So what would you think the ideal is as to how the church should relate to the culture, drawing on these five models?
I went blank. I'm sorry.
Well, just, keep thinking about that. Which one do you think might be the ideal of those five models? Of course, there's been another work more recently than Niebuhr's, critiquing Niebuhr and then trying to add some other newer models of possibilities. But I didn't want to burden you with all that. Get five fingers, five models
right.
enough. So, Peter, what do you think? Particular congregation you're in, what are the five models that fit?
I think my church is in the class of the transformer culture. But because we don't live, you know, we have to choose the culture which is breathing it to the Christian. We carry it forward to the current, you know, period, rather than, you know, because some of the cultures is not bad, but we have to transform, which is bad, so that it is good for the church members. Yes.
Okay. And what do you think the ideal model should be?
I think the ideal model is the Christ, the transformer of culture, because in the end, I'll say like, I remember when Jesus was being baptized by John, what did he say? He said, you should, when John told him, you should baptize me.
Mm-hmm.
Other, me baptizing you. But just let us and fulfill the tradition first.
Right.
So I believe we can do the same.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, without.
Okay.
You choose what is best and then if what is not.
Mm-hmm.
Which does not glorify God.
Right.
Yes.
Okay, Daniel, what do you think? Of your particular congregation you attend, which of the five models would it fit into? And then what do you think the ideal should be?
Yeah, well, when my wife and I first moved into the area, we both wanted to kind of seek a type of church that would transform the culture, which is what I think is, churches should be.
Mm-hmm.
So we did find a small church. They recently got a new pastor within a couple years ago. I believe that before this pastor was more traditional, probably more above the culture. But now, I guess, they're trying to be a little more more focused in the area around them. They are close to the University of Arlington, so they want to focus more, on just college students and stuff like that. And they have a great evangelizing group. I believe that's the type of church that I attend is.
Yeah, I would think that most of us probably see the description of transforming relationship to the culture, the conversionist model is probably the more attractive. Because, we can think of the imagery that Jesus gives us of being salt and being light in the world, even in leaven. And that's just by those three terms. That's something that blends in, mixes, but then changes it. It affects that which it blends into. Salt gives flavor, salt heals, salt preserves, and so forth. Leaven causes, the yeast to rise. And so we get in and mix in with the culture, but for the purpose of affecting it for the good. And so I think we can, in a sense, maybe three out of the five, we could say there's always a bit of a overlap or blending of some of these models, that the church's relationship to culture is no easy pat answer, because times, circumstances, context in which you find yourself, it's always going to be contended with as to what's the right thing or best thing to do. How far should we be involved with the culture and where should we pull back? And so the first two positions he mentions, and as Niebuhr points out, those two don't work. A strict isolationist position is naive. For one thing, you can't do it fully. You had the Mennonites and the Amish and so forth with the freeze framing of a period of time and their mechanics and their clothing and their practices of middle 19th century. But why that time? Well, that's because that's when the group began. Which group doesn't use buttons?
What am I? Never heard that one.
Yeah, they don't use buttons because it's considered vain.
Buttons?
Yeah, cheeky. But things like that. They're oddities.
But completely isolating from the culture isn't then fulfilling the Great Commission. That's not mm-hmm. what we are supposed to be doing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it on the one hand, okay, it might well protect you from some of the corrosive effects of some of the stuff in movies and pop culture and all that. But you lose out on being able to affect the culture. Now, there perhaps are moments when you need to affect the culture by being away from it, to be a little island, to be a light over against the darkness. But that's probably more rare than normative.
That's what I wanted to say. I wanted to say ideal would be above culture, but then again, I wouldn't want to be isolated.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what I would want, but I mean, that's what I feel would be probably to be the best.
Yeah.
Really,
well, except in that model, being above the culture is the way it's described is that you're above the culture, but you're trying to be kind of the best example of the, you're the best model, you're the best aspects of the culture. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and you know, I think it really is the walking by faith and not by sight kind of thing of saying, okay, we have to be discerning. That is, make distinctions between, okay, this practice of our culture, we need to pull back, and it's clear. But there are other things that is not quite so easy, and the danger is to want to make rules and laws about it, you know. And that's when you get the legalism that really burdens the church and eventually drives people away. So it's the joint wisdom of the church historically and the church together as a living body, trying to be wise and discerning about, you know, this isn't the best way to do things, or this is a practice. I know it's popular. I know it's pervasive in the culture, but we probably should pull back from that. You know, those kinds of admonitions in church setting. And those are hard because we good old Americans particularly don't like to be told what to do about anything.
That's my problem. I have a real problem with turning the other cheek or taking stuff from people.
Yeah.
I know you're supposed to or whatever. Mm. It's very difficult. Definitely where I come from. You know, if you let one person do it, then everybody's going
to. Yeah. Yeah, I get trampled.
So what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to let everybody do it?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Yeah, to play those out.
Yeah, it puts you in like a really odd situation. Like even if I try to avoid it, I mean, people will still hit you in the back of the head with stuff. There's no really walking away from situations most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's you have to defend yourself, and that puts me in a situation a lot of times where I'd rather not. But
yeah,
well, what do you do?
Yeah. Well, then you have to take case by case and deal with it. But I think as the author points out, what we see historically within Christianity is a kind of cycle or a movement that somewhat parallels the Judges, the book of Judges, that you'll have the church be in isolation from the culture and then eventually becomes part of it and, you know, of the culture. And then there's a reaction or a repulsion by how bad the culture gets or how bad the church gets, because it's part of the culture, and then pulls back again. And you see this kind of cycle like you see in the Judges where they would prosper, get kind of fat and lazy and sin, and God would punish them. Then he'd send a judge to call them back, and they'd be thankful and faithful. And then they slip back into the culture again later on once they start doing well, a kind of forgetfulness. And the church has kind of done this movement back and forth depending on circumstances through the centuries in different locations. And so one of the things the church needs to do is be nimble, and that is be willing to adjust to different circumstances, not try to lay down hard, fast rules and regulations for how to live out our ethical lives, but rather to know, always discerning what's going on in our culture around us, and we need to kind of huddle up here and pull back away from these practices that are not good. Or, no, here's some things in the culture that's going on that are good, and we can affirm them, you know, as Christians. We can say, yes, the claim for justice and equal rights and so forth, we would affirm that. We would support that and participate in that. So there's that movement of engaging the culture and then pulling back. But it has to be item by item, I think. Well, I think what we'll do is we'll take a break here for about, say, 15 minutes. Then we're going to come back and kind of slog our way through Chapter 5 with all those different theological schools of thought. We'll not spend a lot of time, but it's simply to say, here are some movement of different theological schools of thought and their ethics through this, really, in the more modern era. And because it does provide background as to our own context. And then Chapter 6, we'll look at some of those particular moral issues that he gives a lot of statistics in, and we'll discuss that in kind of a roundtable discussion, what you guys think on it. Okay? So I'm going to turn off the recording for about 15 minutes. We'll start back about, say, 5 after 8 o'clock. Okay? All right. We'll chat again in just a few minutes. Thank you.
time.
Okay. Now, chapter 5 and all that kind of like vegetable soup with all the different theological positions. First thing though, I want to mention is the period called the Enlightenment. And it's after the medieval period, after the Renaissance, and it had several different strains. It's more complex than what I'm going to portray. But the Enlightenment was really the result of a crisis of authority. In 1492, sailing the ocean blue, what was that about?
Good old Christopher Columbus.
Yeah. It was the discovery of the New World. And the encounter of this new land and new cultures was pretty staggering to a lot of Europeans, that there's a whole other world they knew nothing about. And then there was a guy named Copernicus who mathematically depicted the Earth not as the center in which all the sun and all the planets revolved around, but rather the sun, and that the Earth moved around it. Mathematically, he demonstrated that. Well, that was another shakeup, because the church had taught, the Catholic Church had taught that the Earth was the center and everything revolved around it, kind of the cosmic center of everything. So, discovery of the Earth being rotating around the sun like other planets, the fact that there is this whole new land with new peoples they never knew of, and some of those peoples perhaps were behaving more Christian-like. Some Indian groups were, not all of them, but some were more Christian-like in behavior than some of the Christians. But just the fact that there's a whole other, almost like another world, staggered the minds of people in the early modern period, like the 14, 1500s. And it caused a crisis of authority, because what had been authoritative for centuries, really a millennium, was the church and basically classical learning, the ancient Greeks and Rome and so forth, because those two tributaries had come together to make up kind of the content for curriculum and learning in universities and so forth. So the church had been proven to be wrong with regards to the Earth not being the center. It's the difference between geocentric and heliocentric. Heliocentric is the sun being in the center. And so it's kind of like it would be for us discovering creatures on another planet, you know, that were smarter than we are, you know, life on another planet. That would be pretty staggering. Well, for these folks, it was that kind of shakeup of their sense of what's real, you know, and what all it includes.
That just looks weird.
Yeah. The UK.
So the Enlightenment is a response to this crisis of authority. If the church is not someone we can count on to tell us the truth, and then also along with it was some of the science advancing and some of the scientific investigation, like Copernicus and others. And so there was this new direction of, okay, what's authoritative then is human reason, our capacity to think things through, our employment of scientific methodology. And so there became this mindset for centuries ongoing, and again, there's multiple strands, and it's more complex than I'm depicting it, but the Enlightenment continues to have a large influence on us, in which we think individually our reason, our capacity to reason, is the final authority on what's true, what's good, and what's wrong, and what's bad. Well, human reason is a good thing given to us by God, although you have someone like Calvin who would say even human reason is so demented because of the fall, we can't even know or think right. We have to be converted, we have to be saved before we can actually think correctly. On the other end of that scale would be, say, Catholicism would say, yes, we're fallen, reason is scarred, but we still have the capacity to reason well enough to come to knowledge of things, truth of things. So the Enlightenment period set up this sense of individual independence.
I'm the final arbiter of truth. Each one of us then, you know, emphasizes the individuality, individual reason. It kind of undermined the idea of community, church, and so forth. Well, on the heels of the Enlightenment and the emphasis on human reason and human capacity to achieve, we have this array of modern theological schools of thought and their approaches to ethical norms. First one, and it's not necessarily chronologically in order, but from the late 1800s into the 19th century, before World War I, but still ongoing to some extent, would be what's called liberalism. And liberalism, well, tell me, what do you know about it? You hear the theological liberalism. What do you think of when you hear that term? Or what does the book tell you that that's about?
Well, the book says that it tries to harmonize Christianity with science.
Mm-hmm.
I would have not thought of, I mean, I would have thought more along the lines of just being liberal, you know, I think more of politics and people mm-hmm. that are very
right.
broad-minded and on the left. But this actually says that it's trying to match it up with science.
Mm-hmm. Well, because modern man is not going to buy into all this supernatural stuff. That's the argument from, your book doesn't mention it, but a German name, you'll love this name, Friedrich Schleiermacher.
Schleiermacher.
But he argued that, well, modern man can't believe because of human reason. He's not going to believe the supernatural stuff in the gospel or in the scriptures. So,
but he'll believe that man can.
Yeah,
I don't understand evolution at all. I mean, I get what they're saying, but I don't.
Yeah.
I can't understand what they would get that.
Well, the liberal position is to say, okay, the supernatural stuff's not real. It's just ancient man and ancient fears and so forth, and that's the way they describe things. So to modernize the gospel, the scriptures, you excise, you take out all the supernatural stuff, and you make it more emphasis of really along the lines of ethical behavior. It's a good ethical norm in scriptures to follow, and Jesus was a good teacher and moral example and that kind of thing. So it's making Christianity in its teachings just this world. There's no other worldliness to it. There's no supernatural aspect of it. It's taking the position that, you know, by human reason, scientific investigation, we can explain all these things, and it's more of a good religious, ethical, moral norm for us. And so I think we would probably respond to that and say, well, that's undermines a huge amount of what the Christian faith is about. Then you have a reaction to that in the turn of the century, early on in the 1900s, of fundamentalism. And the term was meant to say the fundamentals of the faith we abide by and affirm. And I think your text gives five of those fundamentals. Do you see what those are?
The virgin of birth of Christ, the bodily resurrection of Christ, the infallibility of the scriptures,
inerrancy, yeah.
Inerrancy. The substitutionary theory of atonement,
mm-hmm.
and the imminent physical second coming of Christ.
Yeah.
I think we would probably agree with,
mm-hmm.
with those five.
Yeah, and because those are the key things that liberal position had not denounced, but just simply dismissed because, you know, virgin birth, who can believe that? Bodily resurrection, well, and it was more of an existential thing in which they just, you know, had Christ living in their hearts. He didn't bodily raise. Scripture is not infallible or inerrant. It's simply ancient history telling about this religious person. The idea of the substitutionary atonement, what that means is Christ dying on the cross was a replacement of us
to satisfy the just cosmic justice of God, take away our sins, that kind of thing. And then the second coming, that Christ indeed will truly return and bring all of mankind's history to culmination.
What is the inerrancy of the scriptures?
Yeah, it's saying that the scriptures are true and everything in them is true. To be an error, and then to be in error, to say, no, it's not false, it is true. Well, the problem with fundamentalism, as it played out, because it's more of a reactionary to liberalism, tended towards legalism, rulemaking, and on the ethical side, and became very rigid. And a key figure later on that was truly a scholar and helped broaden the scope of maintaining these fundamentals would be Carl F. Henry. And, you know, he was recognized as a much more broader and astute scholar and not just reactionary. But he kind of chastised fundamentalism for its tendency towards legalism and that kind of thing. Then you have the evangelicals, and it mentions this idea of principalism or emphasizing principles. Daniel, just to pull you guys in, you and Whitney, can you find there, what's this notion about evangelicals and principalism? That's about 111.
You asked, what is the notion?
Yeah, what's this?
Well, regarding evangelicals, they follow this kind of idea of principalism. What's this notion or this term principalism? What's that about?
Yeah, I mean, isn't it that they pretty much focus on principles?
Yeah, certainly there are specific commandments in Scripture, but there's even probably more the idea of principles that the Scriptures give us in contextual, you know, in cultural context. But there's basic principles like the chief one being, you know, love, loving God, loving your neighbor. And so the idea of emphasizing these principles are means by which one decides moral decisions, ethical decisions, because you have principles to draw upon in knowing how you should act or what you should do. Whitney, are you with us?
Yes.
Okay. Also regarding evangelicals and the idea of principles, mentions this conflicting absolutism. That's on page 112, I think. What can you tell us what that is about?
It says the approach defines a method of interpreting the ethical teachings of the scriptures and a way of resolving moral conflict.
Okay. Can you explain that any further?
It looks like it's stating, so for those, like, they don't, I guess, turn to the Bible for specific answers for every question or to always look for a solution to their problems.
Okay. Because sometimes, you know, with the principles, we do find problems of conflicts between principles, like, you know, this principle and this principle, and yet which one should we follow, which is one over the other one, like love your neighbors yourself. And yet, I'm trying to think of a good example. It's not coming to mind real quick, but where you could have a conflict or the principles are kind of at odds with each other over a certain circumstance, and then trying to figure out how to work that out.
The greater good.
Yes, the greater good.
So you may not find the specific item addressed in the Bible, but you can find a principle that you can relate to it.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to discern what is the appropriate action.
Yeah, and in thinking of principles, I think the text mentions this one about, say, women wearing veils in Corinthians, that's mentioned. Should we then say, is that a hard, fast commandment that women in church should be wearing veils? In fact, it wasn't. Maybe less than a century ago, churchgoers in conservative churches, women still did do that, or they wear white gloves and they'd wear hats, you know. But the principle to pull out of that is, from the context culturally, was to make sure that you were dressed and behaving in such a manner that you didn't look like or appear to be like a person of immoral behavior, you know, so that the veil was a kind of symbol of the time for chastity or purity or whatever. And so rather than having to wear a veil, rather it's the principle, the idea behind it, right, to carry out the idea of modest dress or whatever, or behavior, so as not to look like that which would be called into question morally.
So about 10 years ago, my oldest daughter was in high school still. So I had one daughter in junior high, one daughter in high school. And we were visiting a church in Denton.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the second time we visited, we realized that we were out of compliance.
Mm-hmm.
Because the ladies were expected to cover their knees.
Oh.
And so they would have a wrap.
Yeah, yeah.
Or a scarf.
Mm-hmm.
And when you sat down, you were supposed to cover your knees.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't know that. And so we went and bought, you know, wraps and covered our knees. It was interesting that, but it's the same principle applied to today's culture.
Yeah.
It's good that you went and did it. A lot of people would have just sat there and been like, I don't feel like I should have to do it like everybody else.
Or just stormed out.
Or left.
It was a church that was trying to become more multicultural. And
that's probably a good way to start.
We were the outside culture, though. I mean, there was some people that had invited us to come. They were trying to bring, white people into their church and trying to, become multicultural. And we didn't realize that,
They didn't tell you that when they were trying to invite you over? Like, hey, did you realize? Well, I guess they probably thought all their churches
did. They assumed that
we
knew. Yeah. Right, right. So, but yeah, me and both of my daughters,
Were they Pentecostal?
No, it was just an African American church.
Well, I had a roommate. Well, he was a suite mate, and he was Pentecostal, and he was telling me that he thinks, like, in his church, that all women wear hats. He was like, it says in the Bible that they have to wear hats.
Cover
I was
their
like,
heads.
Look, I've never been in a church where every woman's in there wearing hats.
But in the Bible, it said women were to cover their heads.
Yeah,
and that day it was a veil.
Very literal.
The hat.
Very literal when he said
hat.
He said his mom they wouldn't go in there without a hat. And people who didn't have a hat, they made sure to tell him, or they would give him a hat.
Like,
he just brought extra hats.
You know what you should have done is taken a Sharpie and drawn a smiley face on your kneecaps.
But it's just really funny how some people still, as in that instance and as in this one, still interpret, as you were saying about mixing the milk at the Jewish milk that you've been telling that story.
Oh, no, it was in the book.
It was in the book, I think.
The rabbi told him the story like, no, you're not supposed to do it.
Yeah,
I know what you're talking
about. He was being very literal in his interpretation of something.
Mm-hmm.
And people can continue to have those very literal interpretations. But, it's just interesting to see how even today, 2,000 years later, that people still take so many of those things and really try to apply them very literally.
And they don't take the principles out of it. They just take the
Well, I'm just going to highlight a couple others of these different schools of thought. Neo-Orthodoxy is a reaction to the liberalism. Rather complicated, but it tries to recover the Orthodox teachings and yet be sophisticated about modern mindset, trying to do what's fitting as far as its ethical, the idea of being responsible and fitting towards the context rather than specific commands and so forth. Probably one that's in this last century, 1900s, 1960s on, particularly, is liberation theology. And that is
taking a very social justice turn and really drawing upon Marxist doctrine about the church being revolutionary and upheaval of governmental norms to seek justice and so forth. So liberation, they use as their paradigm the idea of Exodus, of, you know, pulling out from governmental oppression and so forth. It also incited things like some of the revolutions that took place in South America in the 60s, late 50s and 60s, Che Guevara and so forth. So Marxism, here's a case in point of culture influencing the church in this case, of liberation theology saying in the name of justice, and as an example, a paradigm with the idea of Exodus, we need to free people up from the oppressions of authorities and governments, and even to the point of the most radical side of that is calling for revolution. And so you had priests carrying machine guns sometimes, that kind of thing. And it was quite a bit of an upheaval. I remember a real vivid picture of was it Pope John Paul II chastising a priest in South America. The priest is down on his knees and the Pope's over him, wagging his finger at him, condemning him for his involvement in this Marxist liberation theology. And the priest asking forgiveness. So anyway. Then more currently you have narrative theology. What is narrative theology? That's the, I think that's the last one listed, isn't it?
Well,
it's neo-orthodoxy I mentioned, yeah.
Secular theology, neo-fundamental.
Yeah, 124, narrative theology and ethics of community and character. Mm-hmm. Just quickly to say, narrative theology emphasizes the narratives of Scripture as being the main source of, you know, storytelling, and these stories are the thing that form us as people of God and that kind of thing, rather than rules or commandments, that kind of thing. But what does narrative theology have to do with ethics, or how does that play out?
They give stories for us to live by. Stories.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, so if we ever get in a similar situation, mm-hmm. or anything, we don't have to really look for laws to do it. We can kind of
see parallels with previous stories. Okay. The positive thing about that is we do tend to think like that. We do tend to think of stories or events in our own life or people we know. Oh, this is kind of like what happened to so-and-so, and I should do this, or I shouldn't do this because look what happened to them when they did that.
They learned from others' mistakes.
Yes, yeah. So there's some strength in that and some naturalness to it. But the weakness is that it's kind of limiting. It's not going to always be easy to tell from a narrative what the right thing to do is with, say, biomedical ethics. You know, it's not going to help you at all. And narrative theology is, like we mentioned with evangelicals, it does call upon you to discern principles within these stories of principles of behavior, say, like looking at King David's life and, you know, what are the good things he did of loving God and serving him and so forth, faithfulness, a good friend to Jonathan and that kind of stuff. But then also, of course, the negative things of his falling into lust with Bathsheba and murdering her husband Uriah. So you have these stories to draw upon. And there's a good aspect of that, but it's not, to me, a comprehensive ethical principle or system.
Because you can't always find one to relate to.
Yeah, and it doesn't always, you don't always have the material, if you will, the stories to help you with some current
events,
issues. Yeah.
So you can say, you know, try to learn from others' mistakes because you don't have time to make them all yourself. But at the same time, because culture continually changes, there's new and bigger ways of making mistakes than there were before. And
well, technology has imposed on us some real moral dilemmas, you know, that they didn't have to contend with. But the problem is that the Bible has a lot of stories, but it's not all stories. There's also some specific commandments, you know. there are specific directives even from some of the apostles. You know, do this, don't do that. You have Paul's sin lists and virtue lists, you know, that do not live like this, live like this, that are very specific. And it's not always narrative or story form. But again, stories are good for creating and developing one's moral imagination. And when I say moral imagination, I mean the operations of your own mind and thinking creatively about how one acts in different circumstances. So you have some principles, you have some commandments, here's a new circumstance, you have to apply them. Well, that requires the power of imagination to know which ones to apply and how to do it. That kind of thing. Well, again, that section of chapter 5 is a little bit like vegetable soup with a bunch of, you know, incoherent letters thrown at you or schools of thought thrown at you. But he's trying to paint you kind of the contours of different schools of development in the modern era, really the last 200 years or even less, and how each one of them has influence on ethical decision-making. And I think you can see some strengths, but a lot of weaknesses in each one, or limitations in each of them. So,
no, I just have a headache.
I thought it was the music.
No, it's not the music at all. I have trainees in town this week, and so they're wearing me out.
Well, at the end of the chapter 5, then, he turns towards model for moral decision-making, and they're kind of general sweeping things.
That is the craziest story.
What's that?
I mean, did that church split?
Oh, yeah.
You know, the lying Baptist versus the truthful Baptist. Well, you know, so even the truthful Baptist, if he was really taking the task on it, is he really going to reveal his family knowing what the Indians are going to do to him? I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
I think it's okay to lie in a situation like that.
Sometimes you got to come to saving your family.
Yeah.
You got to do what you got
to
do.
Yeah, all the way back to Augustine, he writes an essay about lying, and he says that, you know, it becomes, some circumstances are such that there becomes a point in which you choose the greater good. It's still lying, it's still a problem, but you're less culpable or guilty for lying when it's of a circumstance that you're trying to do good, save someone's life. And so it's something that's always been a problem. Like, you know, what do you do with Rahab, you know, lying about hiding the spies, that kind of stuff. And Scripture doesn't denounce her. So, you know, there are dilemmas. We live in a fallen world and we get in a pickle more often than not. So what I'd like to do here for just a few minutes, you mentioned this model for moral decision-making, being true to character, knowing the facts, following guidelines, considering consequences, and then
act responsibly.
So that's what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Isn't that amazing? And we got 5 students. What should we do? Could we perhaps assign each one of these particular aspects of moral decision-making and then take a moment, look at it, and then tell the rest of the class what it's about? I think that's a plan. Okay, so let's start off with you, Whitney. If you'll look at that little section on true to character and just try to, you know, read that and then share with us, describe in your own words what he's referring to in that as a means of moral decision making.
Okay.
And then Daniel, if you'll do the one on facts, knowing the facts. Let's see, where am I? And then Gina, I guess we'll have you do following the guidelines. Corey, consider the consequences. And then Peter, if you'll do the one on act responsibly. And I'll just give you a couple minutes because they're not too long. And we can all listen to the drums. Thank you. Okay, while we have a bit of a respite from the pounding of the drums upstairs, so we can hear each other better, Whitney, tell us then about this one aspect of moral decision-making, being true to character. What's he referring to there?
Basically, what people see in your character is what they would expect you to do as a person. So if you're constantly hanging around, you know, people with negative values and morals, they're going to expect you to do the same. Whereas if they see the positivity that you're putting out, they expect you to have positive morals, positive values. And that all in all kind of affects your ethical decision making. You know, they would expect you to make good decisions based off of your character, what they can see and what they can get out of you.
Okay. And what helps form that character? That may not be fully covered in that section, but, you know, to say, okay, I'm going to be true to my character, but what forms my character?
They had a couple different examples in here. Like, for example, they say, well, it says Stanley. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce his last name. He emphasized how the role, role of the community helped to shape character as far as like habits of the heart. So by being involved with your family, church, your school, your society, you know, those help to build character development.
Yeah. Yeah, our character is formed by our family, you know, our household, and by our church, we would hope, of course, and just the community in general where we live. We kind of, as children growing up, we absorb the sense of right and wrong just by the people we're around and what's being held up as values and what's esteemed as good behavior and what's denounced as bad behavior. So we pick up on all that. I remember this fellow in Alabama, his last name was Plunkett, and he said his dad, a farmer, when he said when he was a young man, going to go do something, you know, as a teenager or whatever, his dad would tell him, he said, just remember, you're a Plunkett. What he meant by that, you're of this family, and this is the way the Plunketts live, and this is the way the Plunketts behave. And so he was saying, remember your name, remember who you belong to, remember what we are like as a family. And so there's that sense of community that, you know, helps instill in you your sense of character, right?
Like, that's where your mama raised you.
Yeah, exactly.
I've told my son that more than once. I didn't raise you that way. You treat that girl right.
That's right.
It must be a mom thing.
And, you know, even the whole idea of it takes a village to raise a child. Well, the whole idea of community, you know, it used to be the case in small towns where a child misbehaving, it would be any adult who would call them to task, you know, and the parents wouldn't be upset by that. In fact, they would expect that. You know, if you see my son doing this or that, you thump him on the head because there was a sense of a community involvement, belonging to each other, and everyone is to maintain those standards. And also, too, I think as we, you know, become individual, mature people, we have to make the decision, and we do along the way, even as kids growing up, make the decision to decide, I want to be like this. I want to be of this kind of character, and that you practice it and you even read stories to help, you know, underpin or underscore those kinds of behaviors, you know, like reading good stories of moral value to children. You know, it says, you know, like famous characters, George Washington, you know, did not tell a lie, he cut down the cherry tree. It may be more fable-like, but the point was there to help instill in children the goodness of the quality of telling the truth, even when it might hurt. You know? So, and I would say, too, as we think about these different items that we're going to cover here in just a moment, with regards to decision-making, ultimately, it does have to be born out of your character. You have to be, it has, your actions belie what's inside you, just as Jesus said. So it is a, ethics ultimately is a indication of what kind of person you are, what your character is, what your soul is like. Now, there are the dilemmas that we come into of, say, some things in biomedical ethics that are not common. But even there, the way we approach those dilemmas says a lot about our character, right? So our character ultimately is to be formed into looking like who?
Christ,
yeah, to be formed into the likeness of Christ, or to grow up into the fullness and stature of Christ. That doesn't mean to be the same height. That means to be like him in behavior and character. So, and I think that's foundational. Because otherwise, ethics becomes simply something of a mental exercise, even kind of a ethical dilemma or ethical calculus kind of stuff, where it's just something of the head where you figure things out. No, it needs to be born out of the soul, born out of your character. So these remaining items are items that are first based on the nature of the character of the person making the moral decision. So, see, Daniel, you're the next one, right, on facts. What's that about?
Yeah, well, before I get into the facts, I also wanted to add on to the whole character building. So, like my wife and I, one of our favorite shows is 19 Kids and Counting. And something that we adopted from them is each month we have different, I guess, characters that we focus on, my wife and I. So, for instance, like this month, we're focusing on being attentive. So, throughout the whole month, you know, we go through verses of what the Bible says of being attentive. And that's something that we just focus on throughout the month. And then if we catch, if my wife catches me, you know, she's telling me a story and I'm not being attentive, then she'll point it out at me, which happens a lot. So, last month it was being orderly. So we focused, on putting things in order, putting our schedule in order, things like that. That's some of the practices that we place.
That's good. Yeah. That raises the awareness of taking on those characteristics.
Yeah. So facing the facts pretty much is just, making a moral decision is trying to find the facts of the situation. So, for instance, what would be the decision to make if you're a church leader and somebody comes in and, robs the church? What would be the, moral decisions to make? So the book pretty much explains, trying to find facts of what the Bible says about, criminals and committing crime and defending yourself, and also theological and socially. So there's four... procedures to take. So first is collecting data, which is asking who, what, where, when, why, and how. Examine the persons that are involved, find out their different perspectives or point of view. Also evaluating that information because he says how incorrect understanding of the facts can lead you to make a wrong decision. And also explore all possible options as well.
Okay, good. You next, Gina?
Yes.
On following guidelines, what's that one?
The commandments that we've been given are there for a reason, basically, and so. Obviously, everybody knows the primary instruction that we have from the Bible is from the Ten Commandments, Sermon on the Mount, and then, to love God and each other. And those rules are all there for a reason. And so if you're trying to make a decision and you can't, figure out what decision to make, you should try to think through each of those rules. And if you can't make a decision with all of those rules, well, then you have to basically base it on which is the greater good or which is the lesser evil is sometimes, you know, what the case is. But in the end, you should be able to state your reasoning for making the decision based on, you know, cultural norms, your principles, your values, and be able to actually, you know, cite how you made your decision and so that you know that it was the right decision for you.
Yeah. I think one line I underlined and even jotted down, the end of the first paragraph, he says, rules help us to use our freedom wisely. That in the contrast into thinking that rules or commandments are confining and restrictive. Rather, rules, commandments can be liberating. And there's an interesting illustration of that. I'll take a moment to tell you that there was a child psychologist for New York City Public Schools, and he went around and surveyed a lot of the schools, some even being in Manhattan, you know, with a busy city and so forth. And typically what they would do is they'd have a corner of the lot of one school set. They'd have a little playground that usually be asphalt and have a chain link fence around it. So, you know, here's your street, your sidewalk around it, chain link fence and a little playground, maybe 8 feet tall or something. Well, the child psychologist gave recommendation to the public school system that these fencing in the playgrounds, small though they were prohibiting or confining the students and stunting their creativity because they felt kind of imprisoned or locked in the because of those chain link fences. So he's a psychologist, right? PhD, and you know those PhDs, they know everything. Kind of like I'm a PhD,
you
I know
get
everything.
Out of the street, more likely.
Well,
the weirdos from just walking in and grabbing a kid. That's what I think.
Well, what they did, they took the fences down, and the first thing they noticed is the kids, when they went out to play, they stayed closer, huddled up against the building, whereas they used to use every square inch and hit the fence, bounce off of it, and so forth. They shrunk back to the edges of the building. And so after, I think, maybe a full year or maybe even one semester, they put the fences back up.
So he was 100% wrong?
Yes. Because it was not only, it wasn't even fully understood in the kids' minds, of course, but it was a kind, the confinement of the fences gave them protection and then gave them a sense of freedom. They had complete freedom to roam anywhere they wanted, play anywhere they wanted on that playground. They could run up and smash into the fence, climb up and jump off of it, and that kind of thing. But with it open, it was open to the whole world. And it was intimidating and overwhelming. Well, that's a nice, tidy little illustration of the fact that rules and regulations are not restraints or confinements only. They rather provide borders so that we can have a freedom within them to live out our lives. Like the Ten Commandments, they're not confining, they're freeing. Wouldn't you rather live in a place where people don't kill, and people don't steal, and don't lie, and so forth? It gives you a sense of freedom. Then you can live more relaxed. If all that's going on, you know, you hunker down in fear.
And also, you know then what those expectations are, because
yes.
You know, who wants to start a new job and you don't even know what it is you're supposed to do, and you're asking your coworkers, well, is it okay if we take a bathroom break, or you know, is it okay if we wear jeans on Friday? You know, you want to know what kind of restrictions, what the dress code are, you know, what time break time is. You know, it actually gives you a sense of calm, and you know
how
then
to operate within that structure, yeah,
and adapt to your situation. You don't have to keep trial and error the whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Paul says in Galatians 6:1 that for freedom we've been saved. But what Paul means by that, because he says very quickly thereafter that we are slaves to Christ. So the perverted notion of freedom is, in our culture, it tends to be free to do anything I want to do, to follow my whims. I want to be, you know, no one can tell me what to do. I'm going to do anything I want to do whenever I want to do it. Well, what that is, actually, is an enslavement to your passions, to your whims, to whatever. Paul talks about freedom as being freed from sin and then being freed towards Christ. It's not freed from this so you can do anything you want. No, it's to freed from sin so you can be free in Christ, which is a positive kind of enslavement that gives life. You know, one is death, the other is life.
So all that is to underscore the fact that the idea of don't have a negative attitude towards rules and regulations always, because often they are quite freeing rather than being restricted. And for ethical norms, it gives us protective barriers, not to keep us within, it's to keep us from going out there where death is, you know, so.
And because they're all there for a reason.
Yeah, and God.
Why? Because I said so.
They're life-affirming. You know, they're really like God's.
No,
I'll use not your rules, but God's rules. You know, they're life affirming. You know, but yes, there is a sense of authority by the parent that I don't have to explain all of it. I just said it.
Mom, what did you say?
Okay. See, the next one is Corey. Considering the consequences. Yeah.
I was just talking about how you should consider what's going to happen, even though you. And do the greater good or the lesser evil, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about teleological again.
Yes, how, yes.
What's wrong with that is we never really know the consequences. I mean, some consequences we know for sure, but then other ones we don't.
Yeah.
We can try to think about the immediate consequences and the consequences that are going to happen later on.
Yeah, that's the thing, is knowing way down the road what those consequences could be. Yeah. As opposed to the idea of commandments or rules are deontological, right? It's focusing on the nature of the rule or the commandment itself. Teleological is considering what's the consequence or how does this affect? If I do this act, what will be the effects? This deontological is saying, no, this is the act, and so I should do this act, regardless of what the consequences are. So, okay, and then lastly, act responsibly. What's he referring to there on 130.
I mean, give me an analogy for driving, because when I was learning driving, we were told when you are on the road, consider everyone else is insane.
Yeah.
So only you are insane.
Everyone else is insane. Okay.
Yeah. So that means if you know that person insane, you have to approach, you know, if you're driving carefully, and so act responsibly. So you have to use imagination in order to act, you know, you have to use your discernment, you know, and you have to consider the consequences. Because if you, like I have seen people actually on the road, some people do a mistake and then the other guy will follow, you know, even trying some, see you like coming in front, you know,
cut you off,
so that you may hit him on that, like that, which is, that's not acting responsibly. So, act responsibly, you have to consider what would be the consequence. Now, if somebody did like that, you might hit him. His car, and then, you know, push it to another, maybe a big vehicle, and he would be crushed. In fact, one time, four people died, and what they were trying to do, I think, they came in front of a 18-wheeler, and they were trying to go slowly, you know.
Oh, like
so,
brake,
I mean, they came and, you know, and then they were crushed, and they died all of them.
Who brake checks an 18-wheeler?
Yeah,
idiot.
Yeah, so that was foolish, you know.
That's
not responsible. So it's good to consider the consequence. They would not have died if they had acted responsibly.
Well, and you think even out of their character, going back to the first one, if their character was not to easily be angered, they wouldn't have been doing that. Okay, so do these five aspects of decision making, does it look easy? Does this help?
Yeah, I mean, they look easy, but applying them isn't always easy.
It's back to what we talked about on the first night of practicing until it becomes a habit, until it becomes part of your normal behavior. Because if you have to work at doing right, then you're not there yet. And of course, we all have to work at doing right all the time, but it should be in our nature to act right most of the time.
starts becoming part of our very nature. Yeah, yeah.
I'm always at these signs up on the wall. Actions turns into thoughts or something. Thoughts turn into words. Words turns into actions or whatever it said. She's like, you should read. I don't know if I'll read that, but I mean, I guess I still remember it. Kind of.
Well, yeah.
I agree with you.
The thought, the word,
but
action.
Yeah. Like, when you were used to saying thank you, if somebody does, they'll say thank you. You'll do it all the time, you know.
Yeah.
So it's just like that.
Mm-hmm.
Other things. If you continue doing it, it will be in your blood.
It becomes automatic, and it's just you. So
yes.
Yeah. Well, there are last remaining moments here for class tonight. We're going to look at chapter 6. And first he mentions, now, you may have found this a bit striking, because as he rattles off a lot of these statistics, we're looking at stuff some 20, 25 years old in some of his material, because it was published in 97. So, and then drawing on statistics that were, you know, predating that. So some of it's a little bit old for us, but some general trends. What I was going to ask you guys, he starts off with some of the trends, you know, kind of ethical issues in the culture. He mentions five social trends on 137. I wondered what you guys thought of those five, and if you thought of some that should be added to it. I guess it's 136 and 137? No. Yeah, right, no, in the middle of 137 there, yeah.
What was cross-cultural future?
These are trends in the culture. I think he's saying the future of the interaction of different cultural groups in our culture, in our society, maybe. Everything from Muslim groups, Middle Eastern people, to Asians, different. I mean, when you say Asian, you have to think in terms of, are you talking about Koreans? You're talking about Japanese? You're talking about Thai? You know, there's all kinds of different cultural groups from the East. And this is the 1990s. This is Tom Sine, middle of page 137. I just wondered if you guys thought there are any trends that you would add to this list or replace on this list.
Well, right now, you know, there's so much emphasis on, you know, the definition of marriage and you know, pushing the I wouldn't get it right. Pushing that's a big thing right now. And did you read in the news yesterday that the Presbyterian Church has now decided,
Presbyterian USA
has now decided to include gay
marriages
into their doctrine and accept them into the church and have gay weddings and accept gay marriage into the Presbyterian doctrine.
Yeah, they say they changed the constitution to read not marriage, not a man and a woman, but
two people. Father and daughter, or you know what? But what that two chapters back, we talked about being of the world or above the world or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. But that is being of the world.
Yeah,
definitely being of the world.
I found it strange.
Kick them all out. Strange. You can't just deny somebody just because they want to be.
It's not a matter of denying them. It's a matter of
accepting it.
You can be accepting of a person. Of a person without accepting their lifestyle.
Yeah.
You can allow the people to come to your church without agreeing
being
to marry them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Whitney, do you see anything in that list of five trends there in the middle of page 137 that you would say is needs to be added as some of the trends currently going on?
I can't really think of anything that I personally would add. I am kind of questioning, like, the, I know she asked about it, but like the actual meaning of the cross-cultural future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what's being said there is maybe better said, the idea of multiculturalism, the trend of, especially in the United States, we have multiple cultures interacting with one another, sometimes in conflict, and just the future of those tensions, you know.
So is that saying like we're blending the culture so much that we're losing the individuality? Or
no, I think he's saying it's a trend, that it's just simply a fact that we have more and more cultures in our society, and that can cause conflicts, it can cause enrichment, you know, both positive and negative things.
Definitely different points of views, that's for sure.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. How about you, Daniel? Anything you would add to that list?
Well, I mean, I would agree to the homosexuality. I mean, it's starting to become a norm. If not, I mean, I already probably believe it is a norm here in the United States. You know, it's normal now to see two girls in the street holding hands. Like the other day at my work, there's two customers that were, you know, homosexual, and they were kissing, you know, in front of everybody, which people, I mean, 20 years ago, you probably think like somebody would probably approach them and say something, but now, I mean, you know, it's just normal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree to that.
Yeah, even now you're considered intellectually sophisticated to be okay with that. And you're not if you don't.
You're judgmental if you're not okay with it. Or you're a hypocrite or whatever.
They say Christians aren't accepting. But like I said, I think that you can accept them as a person, not condemn them. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be ready,
affirming
it, or changing the laws of our country to accommodate it.
Well, one trend I think that is perhaps missing in this is it's not necessarily immediately appearing to be ethical, but what are we doing tonight? What are we using? Especially Whitney and Daniel.
The web.
Yeah, the internet, cell phones, iPads, and so technology in general. That's certainly a trend, is it not? People addicted to their phones. You know, I remember seeing at a hotel, and it was a hotel on the beach, so it was a place for holiday and spring break stuff. And here's a gaggle of young girls, probably 12, 13, 14. Yeah, gaggle. Like a gaggle of youth.
Gaggle. He has a very extensive vocabulary. Yeah, but no, some of
well, here's this group of girls walking along side by side at a hotel, going out to the beach, and it's, you know, it should be fun time all getting together, right? Every one of them is texting, as they're walking along together, texting on the phone, not saying anything to each other.
Probably texting each other.
But that does, it is a behavioral trend, right? And, you know, there's now people who are calling for, you know, trying to have call fasting from your phone or for your technology. Turn the cell phone off, your iPad off for, you know, 6 hours, you know, kind of that, just to get people to not be so manic about it, you know, having to constantly check your email. And so I would say one trend that he, because of his time frame, it is so pervasive in our lives now, is the digital era of technology. It changes our forms of communication and changes the way we communicate, not just the mechanism, but the way we interact with each other with words. You know, when we tweet, I don't tweet, but the limitation of the number of characters and words you can use, right?
Uh-huh.
it truncates our language. It makes it more Tarzan-like. You know, or the abbreviation and so forth.
Certain number of characters, yeah. Like 90
Yeah, you can only use, you know, it only has room for so many letters.
I don't have a Twitter. So.
Yeah. Well, I hear it all the time. You said this was written 25 years ago. Well, my youngest child is 21.
Mm-hmm.
And I
20 years ago, I guess, yeah.
I remember getting my first cell phone. No,
Yeah. Ooh, you had
I remember
right
getting my first. Well, it was the bag phone in my car.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I remember getting my first, and she was a baby. So I actually do remember what it was like before the internet, before cell phones. Some of you people would not.
I didn't have a cell phone until 13.
But I mean, it has completely changed the way that we live. You know it. It's like we didn't have them growing up. We didn't have internet growing up. You had to go to the library and actually pick up a book, you know. But it has just, actually, I was talking to my pastor last night, and I was talking about how we had to use Logos. You didn't have when you were in seminary. Yeah. But, you know, it's just completely changed the way that we live.
We can do degrees online. We can classes online.
The access of information. And there's a kind of neurosis of information overload, because we don't know, there's so much information we can access, we don't know how to handle it.
Or what to believe.
Yes, and what's valuable and what's not so valuable, you know, how to rank it.
And how to filter it.
Yes, yes.
That's good. Yeah.
There's a lot of things that we shouldn't have such easy access to. You know, when our generation was kids, you know, boys had to hide the Playboy under the mattress or something. Mm. Nowadays, all they have to do is
delete recent search. Gone.
Well, the thing about technology is it is indeed wonderful. There's a lot of good, and I would not want to go backwards and lose the technology, especially with regards to the medical field. You know, I don't know. Maybe I could get by on a crunch.
You probably have a wooden knee.
Yeah, wooden leg, maybe. But technology is good, but it's never just positive or just negative. It's never neutral. It's like a two-edged sword. Think of the automobile. It can get us around so much more easily and so much more quicker. Think of the number of people who die because of automobiles and the amount of pollution that occurs because of automobiles. So there's positive, but there's also then the backflow, right?
Just
there's
in case you were wondering, I don't remember what it was like before cars.
Well, people say, hold on, you were not around before cars.
Well, you know, and of course, people used to get killed by riding horses, you know, getting thrown or falling off, but the numbers are tremendously
pollution
because of the movement by way of cars. It's changed the nature of our country with the highway system, people's mobility, and on it goes. And so even something like a cell phone has this two-edged sword-like effect of positive things. It's great to be able to have access, say, to your children, knowing where they are and making sure they're safe and that kind of thing. But then there's all the other problems with the cell phone as well. So just simply to say, one trend that could be added here would certainly be the idea of technology and its effects on us day to day. But another thing I was going to ask you guys, at the bottom of 137 here, this list of issues for the church, he says, of tomorrow. I wondered if you thought there's some things that could be deleted or added to this list. Well, just get the conversation started. Whitney, real quick, on 137, this bullet point list at the bottom of the page of major issues facing the churches of tomorrow, do you think there are some others that could be added to this list?
If you're asking me for like a specific one,
do you see something that's missing? Well, I mean, do you see something kind of off the top of your head that could be added, do you think, is an issue maybe you see in your own church?
I know, I guess for me personally, there could be an issue of like, and I mean, I know this is kind of probably something that churches deal with all over, but I know growing up in mine, like premarital counseling and things like that was pretty big. And if you wanted to marry, to be married by our pastor or within our church, he, not that it was a requirement, but it was definitely recommended that he do premarital counseling just to try to make sure they're prepared and they're ready to make this commitment.
So maybe the whole issue of marriage in general, not just preparation for marriage, because there's, you know, young people are putting marriage off farther and farther. You know, the average age of marrying is, like, males, is it 26 or 7 now?
And it used to be off. That's putting it off further?
Yeah.
When we were kids, we got married right out of high school. When our grandparents were kids, they got married 15, 16 years old. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's now, you know, like for guys, it's maybe even their 30s.
My son's 28 and he's not even thinking about it.
Yeah. And part of that's socioeconomic, you know, people pushing off marriage because of careers or trying to get a good job or education, whatever. And delay it, delay it, delay it. But that has social implications too. How do you stay morally pure, staying single, you know, and not be sexually active and that kind of thing? That makes it difficult. Daniel, how about you? Do you see anything that could be, you see maybe as a issue for the church that's not on this list?
Not off the top of my head right now.
Okay. I'll let you guys hear at the table. Do you think of, I would add again the idea
about the technology.
Yeah.
What I was going to say.
Because, well,
you said before,
and the idea, as you guys mentioned, the idea of access to pornography, you know, especially for, well, not just younger.
Pornography, sexting.
Yeah. Yes.
Whatever, Skyping. Whatever.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Because it's so easily accessible. That's something the church doesn't have to deal with, and at least try to provide instruction for. Mm-hmm. Anything else come to mind that you can think
of? Well, the first one on the list really is something, and again, I'm thinking of when this book was written, but resisting the attempt to define faith in terms of political views. I've said a couple of times, you know, you hear on the radio all the time, well, it's probably because of what radio I listen to, but, you know, I listen to American Family Radio on my way to work in the morning and hear, you know, a couple of different political talk shows from a Christian viewpoint. There's Drive Time coming and going. You know, there's different ones. And, you know, Washington Watch. And it's encouraging Christians to step up, you know, and
instead of being the silent majority, as mm-hmm. it described.
But then at the same time, you have to wonder when you're crossing the line, you know, it's still someone pushing their agenda.
Yeah.
You know, and you have to figure out which agenda most closely aligns with yours. But it is, you know, I mean, that one kind of stung a little bit when I read that, because I do listen to that every morning. I listen to that, you know, political talk show presented from a Christian viewpoint. And, you know, so resisting to attempt to define faith in terms of politics. And
I think that's a reaction to the moral majority back in the 80s and 90s, where, you know, to be Christian is to be Republican, to be Republican is to be Christian.
That's not anymore, is it?
No. Well, as a Christian, it should be, I would think, you don't automatically identify with a given political group just because you're Christian, but rather you're Christian, you can find aspects of good, truth, and justice in several different economic or political groups, but you don't fully resonate or identify with one political group only.
Mm-hmm. Which one supports guns?
Hmm?
Which?
Mostly Republican.
Most Republican. So anyway, that list I thought was interesting, but perhaps a little bit dated. Again, as I mentioned, would probably add the technology issue. And, you know, let's see, does it list there something we, as Christianity in general, has been sorely neglectful of is, and he does mention it, yeah, the environmental issues, that we're caretakers of the creation, and we've not always done a very good job of that, not been very faithful to that. And shy of being a weirdo tree hugger kind of thing, there is, though, I think, balanced proportion reaction to being caring of the creation, you know, caring for it, like caring for the garden, tending to it. We should be not rapists of the creation, but rather use and employ its riches, but at the same time, doing so in a sensible way, not to destroy it. Something funny, that's it?
Oh, I see. Matthew McConaughey's in my head. Not about hugging trees, but it's not about being wasteful either. You've heard that commercial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think that is an area that we tend to be neglectful of. And social justice. I think that's another one that needs to be attended to more robustly. But we're running out of time. Real quick, he mentions some of these key moral issues of drugs and alcohol, then gambling, and then AIDS, and then the environment. And he then analyzes those and gives kind of general guidelines to in reaction to it as a Christian. And I just was wondering, because we only have about 10 minutes or less left, just wondering if you guys felt that you resonated, you matched up with what his depiction of a Christian response to it was, or if you felt a little bit different about it. Just what your thoughts were on, let's take the first one real quick on drugs and alcohol. I think all of us know that abuse of drugs and alcohol is a bad thing, wreaks all kinds of havoc. But his depiction of the Christian response to that, what'd you think? Any opinions, any thoughts added to it, or counterpoints?
I think one of the things, I don't know how the society can try to discourage this peer pressure.
Yeah.
So, and this is the one who is causing our I can remember seeing some people, they find somebody, even let me take a cigarette. Like,
mm-hmm.
There was a time I was in a gas station as a cashier, and they couldn't sell, you know,
to minors,
to anybody who is under 18.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could see somebody when I am 18, you know, the other day he comes 18, I'm 18, because he could see the ID.
Mm-hmm.
So he comes and say, I'm 18 now. But he doesn't know, just because he's 18, that's why he wants to smoke.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't know what is the importance of smoking, you know.
Yeah.
He doesn't.
Right.
Yeah, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. Even, you know, like there, somebody says, I'm 21, but doesn't think the consequences
mm-hmm.
of drinking the alcohol. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a
big problem, you know.
Alcohol abuse runs in my family real, real deep. Mm-hmm. Grandparents, my uncles, cousins, I mean, mm-hmm. my brothers.
Yeah.
I got a ton of alcoholics in my family, so we try to separate.
Yeah, because in that kind of circumstance, there is actually a physiological tendency for some people genetically to
Be
more addicted to it. And I might say, with this whole notion of drugs and alcohol, the addictions,
there's a psychologist who is Christian in background and wrote a really wonderful book, but he basically says all of us are addicts. It's just we're addicted to different things. And he started describing himself about his addiction for needing verbal support, you know, the affirmations of his success or whatever. And it says it can be subtle things, but we're all
addicted
to things, to something. It's just more visible when you're addicted to something that shows up
negative.
Yeah, it shows up so much more. And so he talks about the need for us to try to, whether we may not be alcoholic or drug addicted, but we have addictions we need to contend with just as strongly as they do. I thought that was an interesting twist on the notion of addiction, and it kind of pulls you up short to realize, oh yeah, I do tend to always do this or need that kind of thing. So, like chocolate chip cookies, or ice cream, you know. Anyway, things more severe than that, just in personality aspects of needing affirmation or getting angry quickly, or you know, those kinds of things. So. What I thought was interesting too is the amount of time he spent on gambling, which he's Baptist in background, and gambling is a big hot button in a lot of circles among Baptists to combat it, and there's needs to be. But I just wonder if you guys had a reaction to his depiction of gambling and the reaction to it as Christians.
I've actually heard preachers preach on even like lottery.
Mm-hmm.
And there are serious addictions to lottery tickets.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's usually the lower
class trying to come up
because they're trying to make a quick fortune. I heard a preacher preach one time. He had boys, adolescent age boys, and a relative had brought scratch offs for all the kids at Christmas,
mm-hmm.
and one of his kids had a winning ticket, and he wouldn't even take them to cash in their $5 ticket whatever it was, because he didn't want someone to perceive that he was gambling.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, a group that I work with, you know, put in a pool for the lottery here when it was, I had a big pot here recently, and we all mm-hmm. threw in $10, you know, and it's probably the only time I've bought a lotto ticket and 10 years.
Hmm.
But all the same, if I had won it, I would have given the church their portion. Would they have declined it?
No, they
didn't
decline it. They're not going to decline that.
So, but I mean, I don't know. I mean,
functionally, especially the lottery system, it basically ends up functioning as a tax on the poor, because they're the ones, I mean, statistically, the people who tend to buy them are lower socioeconomic class. And so, in a sense, it's like a tax, because the money's then used for good things, you know, like supporting educational system and so forth. But it's a kind of, for the government, it's a kind of tax on the poor to get earnings for these particular aspects of state government.
My dad has a buddy that, I mean, he doesn't make very much money. He makes mm-hmm. pretty much just, he goes to churches every day, spends $2 on the wings and whatever, and he lives in a tiny little shack, but he buys lotto tickets every single day.
Yeah.
And he'll win $100, but he'll spend $200-$300
on
lotto tickets, and he went once a week maybe.
Yeah,
he buys a ton of lotto tickets, and he ain't got money to be spending. Mm.
I have a friend that's like that on slots. They actually do live comfortably, but you know, they go on cruises periodically. They go to the little
the convenience store slot.
And she spends a lot of money doing it, and she gets really excited when she has a win. And I'm like, yeah, but how much money did you put into that? I just can't.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been on cruises twice. I've been to Vegas a couple of times. One time on business, and one time for another purpose. But both times, I'm just like, I can't go. And first of all, I have better things to do with my time.
Mm-hmm.
But secondly, I just can't justify sticking money in that.
Yeah. Yeah.
More than once. Yeah. Like, oh, I lost that time.
Well, I think one of the key things to know at the beginning of the section on gambling is the amount of pervasiveness in the number of states involved in forms of gambling mm-hmm. from just not very long ago. It's become almost nationwide, and it's problematic. I mean, there's all kinds of fallouts from it. But we're running out of time. Real quickly, though, Daniel or Whitney, do either one of you have a comment? So you guys get to have the last word on these issues he raises. AIDS, alcoholism, gambling. Any thoughts or comments here to close out?
Yeah, I like that. As far as alcohol, he pointed out different aspects, like how, you know, traditionally, you know, Hebrews use wine, like, in cases of celebration, or also, you know, for health. But, he also goes into, you know, I guess the more, I guess, you know, like the Nazarites, like, they didn't drink wine, also John the Baptist, like, more people that were, I guess, more passionate in following Christ, restrained from drinking wine, and also, yeah, it talks about, you know, like the Bible talks about that you shouldn't get drunk, but it doesn't necessarily say that you shouldn't drink at all. But the point that I'm getting at is that, you know, people, like for me, for instance, I feel like it's okay to drink, you know, wine on occasions, just because, you know, the Bible says I just don't get drunk off of it, you know. But I do like that he pointed out, you know, how alcohol affects society and causes, well, I guess not causing, but it's a contributing factor, you know, to manslaughter, you know, robberies, murders and stuff like that. So it makes me think, you know, like I don't want to, you know, bring anything to my life that causes such things, you know, into society.
Right. Whitney, any thoughts or comments on any of those items?
The focus that he put as far as group members being a part of the church and maybe have come into contact with AIDS, I kind of like the spin he put on it with the acronym AFRAID, basically, which is fear regarding AIDS. And just the simple fact that, you know, because they are ill and it is a deadly disease and, you know, coming in contact can always be dangerous, that they shouldn't be shunned or, you know, not helped or being supported because of their illness.
Yeah, very good. Well, and even like the recent Ebola cases, how people were almost overly afraid on some of those storylines, got a little crazy, but same kind of scenario as far as people's reaction. But okay, well, we will do this all over again next week. We'll meet back again and we'll cover the next few chapters and be moving towards the creation of your own moral decision-making paper, idea, concept. So we'll keep progressing. If you have any questions along the way, shoot me an email. Meantime, get all your assignments done, and we will see you next time. Thank you all.
Did you stop your recording?
Yeah, about to.
Just leave it on for 45 minutes.
Come on. Here.